Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I
So, as many of you know, I practiced for 5 years at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which was a Zen monastery in around Big Sur. It's quite remote, and the monastic schedule is quite demanding. And while I was there, the abiding teacher was a lay teacher named Leslie James. And she mentioned several times in several different Dharma talks that when she had practice discussion with students, they would bring all kinds of different questions and concerns to her. And after a few years, she realized that really every practice discussion, every student in every practice discussion was asking the same question. Am I okay? And whatever question they seemed to be asking, she tried very hard to answer, am I okay? And I don't know, I've just been feeling that a lot recently. Feeling inspired by Leslie James, as I often feel. Leslie never usually does not bring books or even notes to a Dharma talk. And I thought at first that I was going to give that kind of Dharma talk. But instead, I've got 4 books. It's kind of a sickness. I was on the Seattle Soto Zen website, and I saw the lovely photograph there of Jundo Steve, and I really liked the picture of his smiling face, but I was paying much more attention to the books behind him, and I was like, oh, he's got a couple of books I don't have, and I actually just ordered them last week. But you know, there are worse compulsions to have. At least that's what I tell myself. Yes, I have a problem, but it could be much worse. So last week I talked a bit about how I've been struggling recently. Mostly with health problems. I was very, very sick for several weeks. And it took me away from the Sangha, and I really questioned whether I even deserve to come back after abandoning you all, after being, you know, so weak. Was I still deserving of love, considering how flawed I am? And I have been so moved by the responses I received after that Dharma talk. Hearing how many of you are struggling with the same kinds of questions. And, you know, I've talked to some of you about it. And, you know, they'll tell me how you're all messed up. And before I can say anything, you say, it's not because of the pandemic. I was screwed up before the pandemic. I'd still be screwed up even if there weren't a pandemic. But the pandemic didn't make anything any easier, did it? So, you know, I think there's, you know, a lot of struggling happening. And, you know, we can find external reasons for it. Or we might never find any reason for it. And I think it's because the reason is that we're humans. I was really struggling at the monastery, and Norman was there for a couple weeks in the summer. And I laid out for him everything that was going wrong in my life and at the monastery. And he said, you know what the problem is with Tassajara Zen Mountain Center? Said, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I can tell you what the problem is with Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. And I said, what is it? And he said, everybody there is a human being. That is true, right? We didn't know what we were getting into when we were born, but our human life is full of struggle and difficulty, and there really isn't a cure for it. And I really want you to leave this Dharma talk feeling reassured that the answer to am I okay is yes, of course. You're okay, you're worthy, you're loved, you're enough. I have a metta, loving kindness practice that I do every day for many, many years now, at night, actually. I really feel strongly that loving kindness practice is very helpful, for myself and for others. You know, if I can't be helpful, then at least I'm not creating more suffering as often as I used to. I hope. And a real struggle with trying to pass on this loving kindness practice is that the traditional teaching is that you begin with generating a feeling of loving kindness for myself, and then the second step is a beloved person, and then a neutral person, and then a difficult person or an enemy. And a lot of people get kind of stumble right out the gate, because I don't think a lot of us are very good at generating loving kindness for ourselves. And more than that, we hear that, well, you can't really love and accept others until you've learned to love and accept yourself. And then we hear the loving kindness practice guidelines, and it's like, it seems to agree with what we were told. But that's not true. It's not true at all. And, you know, when I was doing a lot of these practices with the Brahma Viharas, there's a teaching on the far enemy and near enemy of each. And the far enemy of compassion is hatred. But the near enemy is pity. So feeling compassion for someone is sort of feeling it's a feeling that involves a kind of sense of equality. You know, I see myself in this other person, whereas pity kind of puts you above the other person. And when I was reading about this, I became very concerned because I wasn't sure how to tell compassion apart from pity. So I was doing these compassion practices and I was like, wait, is that compassion or is that pity? And I really had myself tied up in knots. And I finally talked to Norman and Norman said, just forget about it. Just do the compassion practices. Which was very, very helpful. So with the loving kindness training I do, if people find it difficult to generate loving kindness for themselves, I say, well, then don't start there. Start with the beloved person. Now, maybe do the beloved person, then the neutral person, and then try this yourself. And, you know, the reason for the teaching being laid out that way is because the Buddha said, you know, start with the practice that's easiest and then work your way up to the hard ones. So I guess in the time and place that the Buddha was teaching about loving kindness, people apparently found it easier to love themselves than we do today. There's actually a sutra about the Buddha talking to a king and queen. And it starts with the king asking the queen, who do you love most in the world? And his wife said, well, oh, king, my husband, I love you a lot. I mean, really. But I don't love you most in the world. He was like, well, who's this other guy then? And she said, no, I think I really love myself more than anyone else. And the king thought about it. He's like, you know, I think I might feel the same way. So they asked the Buddha about it. And the Buddha said, oh, Your Majesty the Queen, what an excellent spiritual insight you've had. That is very well done. It's true. Everyone loves themselves best of all. And that is the foundation of compassion. To reflect on how much I cherish myself and then to realize everyone I meet cherishes themselves just as much. That, you know, they get just as scared as I do about having enough money. They feel just as hurt as I do when someone stands them up on a date. They get just as embarrassed as I do when someone points out their mistakes in public and shames them. And so realizing how this hurts me, I don't want to inflict that on anyone else. But it doesn't mean that you can't love anyone else until you love yourself. I knew another Zen student who said he didn't understand the value of self-compassion until he had a school-age child. And his child, something happened at school, and he heard his child talking to himself and saying, I'm so stupid. And he realized, oh no, my kid probably picked that up from hearing me talk to myself that way. It's sort of the same thing, right? I don't want my kid to talk to himself the way he hears me talk to myself. So what do? Well, you learn to talk to yourself a little bit better. Because, you know, when your kids are small, they want to be like mom and dad. So I think there's still a lot of wisdom in the Buddhist teaching about how everyone cherishes themselves most of all. You know, I don't think we can really escape from it. We're always going to be the main character in our life story, right? There was one of Dickens' novels. It started out in the prologue. The character said, "It's up to you, dear reader, to decide if I'm the main character in this story, or if that role should fall to someone else." But you know, there really can't be an impartial jury in that because this book was written in first person, right? So the main character is the one who's telling you the story, whose eyes you're seeing events through. And it's the same with us. I think what is unfortunate is some people, some of the most lovely and loving people I know, have a tendency to cast themselves as the villain rather than the hero. And I think that causes a lot of suffering. And I think maybe I might have done you a disservice by saying, don't worry about it so often. I still think you should start with what's easiest. Now, if it's hard to generate loving kindness for myself first, then don't start with that. But also, you know, don't quit before I get around to generating loving kindness for myself. I think, you know, we're going to be stuck with ourselves until we die, so we might as well try to make that relationship as healthy as it can be. And also, I think, am I okay? Good. I got a warning message that I was unstable. my connection has been fading in and out this weekend, but you know that we need to have some confidence in ourselves and our practice. My first Sangha was a Chinese Zen community in Canada. I was one of the few Westerners there, which gave me a great excuse if people asked me to do something hard, because I would say, I'm just a Guaylo, I don't know what I'm doing. Eventually I wore out that excuse. And the abbess scolded me very, very strongly. I don't remember all of what she said, but the last thing she said, you should always be ready to learn and ready to teach. And I was like, oh, is that all? And I think that's you know, there's a traditional teaching. I was reading about it in Kyogen Carlson's book, the teaching of great faith, great doubt, and great determination. Those are the three ingredients for great enlightenment. You know, so having confidence tempered with humility and a kind of stubborn optimism. You know, Sojin Roshi, Mel Weitzman, he really embodied great faith. He talked a lot about the practice as, you know, he said, I don't ever have to worry about my practice failing me, but sometimes I failed my practice. And he would say that it's like tuning into a radio station, KBDA, tuning into Buddha, and, you know, just allowing Buddha to manifest through him. And he talked about it like, you know, it was just something you could do on a Sunday morning because you felt like it. I think he got that from his teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who's the first book friend I brought to discuss great faith. And this is from Not Always So. The chapter is Be Kind with Yourself. I want you to have the actual feeling of true practice. Because even though I practiced Zazen when I was young, I didn't know what it was. When I saw great teachers or listened to their lectures, I was deeply moved, but it was difficult to understand those experiences. Our aim is to have complete experience or full feeling in each moment of practice. What we teach is that enlightenment and practice are one, but my practice was what we call stepladder Zen. I understand this much now, and next year, I will understand a little bit more. That kind of practice doesn't make sense. I could not be satisfied. If we do not have some warm, big satisfaction in our practice, it is not true practice. Even though you sit trying to have the right posture and counting your breath, it may still be lifeless Zazen because you are just following instructions. You are not kind enough with yourself. Do not count your breaths just to avoid your thinking mind, but take the best care of your breathing. If you are very kind with your breathing, one breath after another, you will have a refreshed, warm feeling in your Zazen. When you have a warm feeling in your body and your breath, you can take care of your practice and you can be satisfied. When you are very kind with yourself, naturally, you will feel like this. When you do something with a warm-hearted feeling, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, is there, and that is the true you. You don't have to wonder where Manjushri is or what he is doing. When you do things with a warm-hearted mind, that is actual practice. That is how to take care of things, and that is how to communicate with people. Some of you are priests, and some of you are not priests, and each of you will go your own way. Those of you who are married, and those of you who are not married, each have your own way to extend practice in your everyday lives. Although our situations are different, practice is the same, and we all meet Manjushri. Even though he is one, he is everywhere. with everyone and everything. Whatever you do, whatever your practice is, Manjushri is there. The secret is not to forget the true mercy of Buddha, who takes care of everything. If we lose this point, whatever we do doesn't make sense. So we put emphasis on warm heart and warm zazen. The warm feeling we have in our practice is enlightenment. It is Buddha's mercy and Buddha's mind. The point is, while inhaling and exhaling, just to take care of the breath, like a mother watches her baby. If a baby smiles, the mother will smile. If a baby cries, its mother is worried. That kind of close relationship, being one with your practice, is the point. This is how to improve your practice in order to have good control over your desires and your everyday life. Then you will have big freedom. That is the goal of our practice for priests and for lay people. Please take care of your practice. Please be very kind with yourself. Thank you very much. And then, hand in hand with great faith is great doubt. I talked with a student the other day, and they were very upset. And they were saying, you know, Kanchan, I'm an absolute mess. And I said, yeah, I know. Everyone is. She's like, no, I wasn't like this until I started practicing with you. The more I practice, the worse it gets. And I started laughing like I'm laughing right now. And like Reverend Jeff is laughing. And he got even more upset. He's like, oh, yeah, you think it's funny. But I'm not kidding. It's the truth. It wasn't why I was laughing at all, because I do believe it's the truth. I'm not laughing at him. I was laughing at myself because, yes, that is a big part of practice. And, you know, it's one that I don't think Suzuki Roshi talks so much about, and Sojin Roshi didn't really talk so much about. But fortunately, Pema Chodron talks about it in her book, The Places That Scare You. Yeah, she says, we might assume that as we train in compassion, our habitual patterns will start to unwind, that day by day we'll be more open-minded, more flexible. But what actually happens with ongoing practice is that our patterns intensify. In Vajrayana Buddhism, this is called heightened neurosis. Does that sound familiar to anyone? It's not something we do on purpose, it just happens. We catch the scent of emptiness, and despite our wish to remain steady, open, and flexible, we hold on tight in our habitual ways. This has been the experience of everyone who has ever set out on the path of awakening. All those smiling, calm, enlightened people you see in pictures or in person have had to go through the process of encountering their full-blown neurosis. We start to interrupt our ordinary ways of calling ourselves names and patting ourselves on the back, and we are doing something extremely brave. Slowly, we edge toward a more open state, but we're moving toward a place of no handholds, no footholds. This may be called liberation, but for a long time, it feels like insecurity. Let me give you a few examples of heightened neuroses that develop because we practice. One is to develop a new self-critical storyline based on spiritual ideals. If we train to become a good person or to escape from being a bad person, then our thinking remains just as polarized as it was before. We'll use our training against ourselves, trying to jump over issues we're avoiding so as to attain some idealized notion of all rightness. This is not unusual. Welcome to the human race. But because of our training, we can start to see clearly what we do and begin to practice compassionate inquiry into our own process. What is happening to us? Do we feel inadequate? Are we still getting caught up in the same dramas? There's also the opposite scenario. We use our training to feel superior, to increase our sense of being special. We are courageous to do this training. We're turning our lives around. We're proud to be doing something so difficult and so rare in this world. We use the practice to build up our self-image and increase our arrogance and pride. Another neurosis that can get heightened is avoidance. We wish to surrender our useless baggage, but in the process, we use the teachings themselves to distance ourselves from the chaotic, unsettling quality of our lives. In an attempt to avoid the fact that our partner is alcoholic or that we're in an abusive relationship, we earnestly train in relaxing into spaciousness, openness, and warm-heartedness. We try to use our spiritual training to avoid the queasy feeling in our gut. The point is that we bring our habitual ways of gluing ourselves together right into our compassion practice, right into the training and ungluing. As we tentatively step out of our cocoon, we're bound to be afraid and grab onto what's familiar. Without ongoing patience and kindness toward this inevitable process, we'll never see that it's wise and compassionate to relax into this open state. We have to gradually develop the confidence that is liberating to let go. Continually, we train in compassion. It takes time to develop enthusiasm for how it really feels to remain so open. Practicing compassionate inquiry into our reactions and strategies is fundamental to the process of awakening. We are encouraged to be curious about the neurosis that's bound to kick in. This is how we get to the place where we stop believing in our personal myths, the place where we are not always divided against ourselves, always resisting our own energy. This is an ongoing practice. From the instant we begin this bodhisattva training until we constantly trust the freedom of our unconditional mind, we are surrendering moment by moment to whatever is happening in this instant of time. With gentleness, we can surrender our cherished ways of regarding ourselves and others, our cherished ways of holding it all together, our cherished ways of blocking our own innate compassion. We do this again and again over many challenging and inspiring years, and in the process, develop an appetite for groundlessness. Yeah. A lot of people don't talk about that, right? That's one of the things I love most about Pema Chodron. I'm hoping to do a Tuesday evening class later on this spring, probably when things fall apart. This was the places that scare you, but I'll probably start with when things fall apart. But you know, that's part of it, right? Sometimes that is what happens. The more you practice the more your neurosis gets heightened. That's why Chogyam Trungpa famously said, someone asked him for advice on spiritual practice, and he said, well, it's better not to start. Of course, he said that, you know, with such a warm smile that everyone was like, oh, he must be joking. He wasn't joking. Unfortunately, once you've started, you really have to keep going. Is the third ingredient in deep awakening, in great awakening, is great determination. For this, I brought Kjogan Karlsson. He actually has in his book, You Were Still Here, he's got several chapters, one on each faith, doubt, and determination. But this is the first chapter in his book. It's called Way-Seeking Mind. About 4 years into my time at the monastery, I had a crisis in my practice, particularly in relationship to my teacher. I was one of her primary attendants, and this could be difficult. Sometimes I felt as if I had no space of my own, and sometimes I felt like an object, a piece of furniture in her world. She would get into difficult moods, and during one of these periods, we had a disagreement. I was trying to set limits for myself, and in the process, I wrote a letter that really hurt her. All of a sudden, my whole tenure at the monastery was on the line, my vocation and the priesthood in question. I was ready to pack it in, give up my ordination, and return to lay life. But Roshi told me not to do that and instead take some time to figure out what to do next. During this time of crisis, I questioned everything. What am I doing here? What is this all about? Why do this? At another Zen center I was part of, Calgary Soto Zen, we had a joke that our slogan was, "What was I thinking?" We even talked about having t-shirts. Calgary Soto Zen, what was I thinking? Once we ask why, the question can suck everything into it like a black hole. Why do this one thing becomes, why do anything? Why am I here at all? Why keep breathing? When we compare one decision with all the other options, all other possible decisions, we enter the black hole of doubt. Why do anything? A baby is born and it takes its first breath with all the strength in its tiny body. It doesn't ask why. Its breathing is a natural functioning of things like grass sprouting. As we grow older, we lose sight of this natural way of things. As babies, we breathe and grow with original mind, original intention, and original function. Then we complicate everything. We lose track of our real task, which is to be ourselves naturally while functioning authentically. We lose track of our real task, which is to be ourselves naturally while functioning authentically. When a seed sprouts, it does so in the dark, down under the ground where it is wet. Without fail, the shoot grows up and the root grows down. It does this without any external prompting other than gravity and the warmth of the earth. The motivation is in the seed itself. Aspiration and real practice come from this same place. It's intrinsic, and in the same way that grass has the power to break up concrete, it can shatter habit energy and shift the whole earth. This aspiration, known as the mind that seeks the way, sprouting from this intrinsic place despite conditions, will shatter our false conceptions and it is the only thing that can really change the world. The mind that seeks a way is the only thing that can really change the world. This aspiration arises in prisons, in concentration camps, and amid the worst degradation. When people take a look at their lives and the world around them and say, there's got to be something more than this, they are ready. They're ready to go down beneath appearances and the superficial aspects of life. And there they find the seed of awakening. We can't predict it. We can't manipulate it. When conditions ripen, that seed will sprout. It's a natural arising innate in us. We are born to become Buddhas. I had to realize that my aspiration to practice must come from the soles of my feet. I could not depend on anyone or anything else. It had to rise up from the core of my being. In the months that followed, my teacher and I reconciled, and I continued to serve as her attendant for another 5 years. But this shift, finding my aspiration despite all conditions, could be called the first watering of the seed of enlightenment. Great faith, great doubt, and great determination. Please have faith that you are Buddha. Please doubt the habitual patterns that trip you up over and over again. And please develop your willingness to always, always step up to learn and to teach when you're called upon to do so. That's my wish for all of you. Reverend Carlson talks about, finding, Buddha's mercy. And Reverend Jundo Steve, during the Zazenkar Dharma talk, talked very eloquently about Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And, finding some stable image that we can have confidence in when it's difficult to have confidence in ourselves. For me, it could be Leslie James. But I know that many of you don't resonate with Buddhist mercy or with loving Kanon. So I have another Leslie James. This is from a poem by Marie Howe called My Dead Friends. I have begun when I'm weary and can't decide an answer to a bewildering question, to ask my dead friends for their opinion. And the answer is often immediate and clear. Should I take the job? Move to the city? Should I try to conceive a child in my middle age? They stand in unison, shaking their heads and smiling. Whatever leads to joy, they always answer. To more life and less worry. I look into the vase where Billy's ashes were. It's green in there, a green vase. And I ask Billy if I should return the difficult phone call. And he says, yes. Billy's already gone through the frightening door. Whatever he says, I'll do. I have begun when I'm weary and can't decide an answer to a bewildering question, to ask my dead friends for their opinion. And the answer is often immediate and clear. Should I take the job, move to the city? Should I try to conceive a child in my middle age? They stand in unison, shaking their heads and smiling. Whatever leads to joy, they always answer. To more life and less worry. I look into the vase where Billy's ashes were. It's green in there, a green vase. And I ask Billy if I should return the difficult phone call. And he says yes. Billy's already gone to the frightening door. Whatever he says, I'll do. Thank you very much. Please take very good care of yourselves. And please be very kind to yourselves.
And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosho!